Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, June 30th. With us now is the poet, author, and president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, Elizabeth Alexander. She has a deep and heartbreaking essay in The New Yorker called The Trayvon Generation about her own 20 and 22-year-old sons and really all black Americans around 25 years old or younger, growing up with so many videos of black people being killed and the effects on mental health, among other things. But the essay is teeming with a mother's love and a love for dance and community artistic expression, and does also contain hope. This is essential reading on so many levels, in my opinion, if you can take some time from everything else. It's also beautifully, beautifully written, as we would expect from Elizabeth Alexander. Her memoir, The Light of the World, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist when it came out in 2016. The Mellon Foundation, of which she is president, makes grants in the arts and humanities and has just announced this morning a new focus on social justice and a new program to place 500,000 books in prisons and juvenile facilities across the U.S. So we'll get to that, too. Ms. Alexander, an honor to have you today. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, it is an honor to be in conversation with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Can I start with the part of the essay that's about you as a mother? You write, "I believed I could keep my sons alive by loving them." And you wrote, "My love was both rational and fantastical." Can you start wherever you want and talk about the mix of feelings and limitations you were getting at about being a mother to sons in the Trayvon generation?
Yes, I say in that essay, and I had never stated it to myself so plainly, but you know, there's that way that writing sometimes gets you to the things that you believe most dearly, that when you have a child, when you're responsible for a child, your fundamental job is to keep that living being alive. And what I think we are facing is that all of the love, all of the care, all of the attention, all of the sheltering, all of the things that we do as parents sometimes still cannot protect our children from the targeted racial violence and hatred that that corrodes our country. And what is particular to this generation of young people, the generation of my sons, is that they have watched these murders. They have watched these attacks over and over and over again on their cell phones. So they have had to be witness to their own representative murder and violation. And as a parent, how do we think about that? How do we think about what counters that? How do I think about my own experience in raising my children as being representative? Because I think that for all of us, whatever happens inside of our nuclear families has to connect us to widening circles of human beings. We have to be responsible, I believe, not just for the children who are ours, I'm putting that in quotation marks, but also, you know, all of the children within reach of our circles. And beyond that, and there I'm talking about the young people who we can actually touch. So in my case, that's, you know, young people in the neighborhood, children of friends. I was a professor for decades, so all of those young people. How do we think of ourselves as adults as being responsible to a generation of young people and understanding that they are dealing with something in a particular way that we haven't quite had to deal with?
Dr. Alexander, you wrote that you worry about this generation of young black people and depression. And for you as an artist and a watcher of the arts, you see it reflected in TV shows like Atlanta and Insecure. I'll just cite a little bit of what you write about that, about some of the young characters in Atlanta and Insecure. You wrote that you ask every young person who will listen, don't you think they're about low-grade undiagnosed depression and not black hipster ennui. So what's the distinction you're making there between depression and ennui?
Well, I think that with, I do think also that the art tell us what time it is, right? You know, that's the subterranean notes from the underground that let us know kind of more profoundly what is going on in culture. And I think looking at Atlanta and Insecure in particular, when Insecure came out, it was talked about as, you know, a black hipster version of Lena Dunham's Girls. And Atlanta was also described in similar terms, these, you know, young, stylish, you know, interesting talking, young people sort of figuring out their lives. But I felt a very particular social sadness in these characters, in the things that were unexplained. So the character of Earn, for example, and he is the lead character and the character who's the doppelganger of the creator of the show. There's never given a sort of an explanation for why he's underemployed, what his sort of ill-defined relationship is with the mother of his child, why we hear that he dropped out of Princeton, but we're never given that story. In Insecure, what I think is fascinating is that Issa Rae, and I love these shows, and I think these creators are quite brilliant. Mm-hmm. I would wonder similarly, you know, they kind of keep blowing up their lives, not achieving themselves fully. And it's not, you know, I sound a little bit like, you know, the mommy who says, you know, why don't you have a better job? And that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, what is the sorrow that gets in the way? And indeed, in this season of Insecure, they are dealing with mental illness on the surface in several characters. We see one character with postpartum depression, another one who turns out he disappears. We don't know why. He's dealing with bipolar disorder. There's quite a bit of surfacing of that issue. So I think that in the fiction of those shows, it corresponds with Gwendolyn Brooks's great phrase, "gobbling mother eye," with which I think that with very bright young people who can make you laugh and dance and are clever and have read interesting things, I'm always listening underneath that, because I think how can it not take its toll? How can it not take its toll to see beautiful young Elijah McClain playing the violin for Cats, to see hear his language saying, I'm an introvert, you know, describing himself in that hyper-articulate way that we sometimes see in this generation. And it still got him murdered because somebody thought the police, because he looked quote-unquote suspicious, was a good idea. I mean, you know, our children, why do they have to have all of this in their heads when what we should be wanting from them is the power and brilliance and might and intelligence to get us the hell out of this mess our society is in right now?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They need space and support to do the generational work that we need them to do. And I think that at a very minimum, the power and insistence with which so many young people are leading the protests is something that I follow.
Angelique, in West Babylon, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Alexander. Hi, Angelique.
Hi, Brian. I'm such a huge fan, and I live in Oakland now, but I'm staying with my sister in West Babylon, and I have a community group that is from actually a bar, a piano bar in Oakland, mm-hmm. and we've stayed together throughout COVID-19. We've been talking, but actually besides performing for each other, we started talking like about race and about all the things that are happening. And on one of the first meetings, we talked about how there's a woman who came to our group, and she was very hurt because one of her friends said on social media that the first killing that's really affected her, and this is a middle-aged white woman who said this, that the first killing that's really affected her is George Floyd. And she was just like, I could ramble on a list of names, mm-hmm. of like, this is not the first. the fact that this was the first that hurt you. And I said, you know, as somebody who's a young person, who's younger than the average age of the group that I hang out with, the first one that really tore me up was Trayvon Martin. I remember crying for weeks over that. And I remember talking with my ex-boyfriend, who was white at the time, and saying, like, how could he have been killed over a package of Skittles? And he was just like, well, you don't know what he was doing before that. And just kind of making excuses as to why it was justifiable. And it just, it's always stuck with me. That one, you know, it's that first heartbreak that really sticks. So I always think of Trayvon Martin.
Elizabeth Alexander, you want to talk to Angelique from Oakland?
Yes, I do. Yes. Hi, Angelique. You know, I'm glad to hear a couple of things in what you're saying. One is the historicizing the heartbreak, right? I mean, so in earlier generations, it might have been seeing Emmett Till's murder, or it might have been the Rodney King beating. But I do think we have these kind of signal, as you put it, heartbreak moments that generationally define us. And what I think is so important, you know, when people say that their understanding begins with George Floyd, is that we understand that this public violation of black people rooted in race-based hatred and the understanding that black people, or trying to put forth the understanding, are not fully human, of course, goes back hundreds of years to our arrival on these shores in the context of the slave trade, and then the segregation and lynching and violence that has followed. So George Floyd was just an inflection point. I think you talk about meeting in a piano bar and playing music for each other, and one of the things I try to get to in the article that I think is so beautiful and important is that I do think in making community and sharing culture, and I talk about a dancing. And, you know, what does it mean when you have bodily vulnerability? And by the way, I have sons, and I'm talking about some cases that are of young black men being murdered. But of course, I'm talking about all black young people. That what does it mean when you have that vulnerability in society to nonetheless be fully sovereign in your body, to find joy in your body, to find joy in your community, and to share the joy that goes across time and space of coming together with music and dance. It doesn't make the horrors go away, but I see that as an insistence, a refusal to let collective life force be extinguished.
Yeah, and I'm also a public school teacher in Oakland. I work at an All Dead site, and I've radically changed my teaching over the summer, like, to include stating every day that the reason, because I teach mostly black and Latino children, and I'm a light-skinned person of color, I always tell them every day, the reason that we're learning this mathematical language is so that way we can gain power, so that way our voices are heard, that way we get seats at the table. And I try to, like, share that with my kids.
Angelique, thank you so much. Jennifer, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Alexander. Hi.
Hi. Brian, I'm a huge fan, longtime listener, first-time caller.
Glad you're on.
And Elizabeth, I read your article the other night, and I was just blown away. It's poetry. I sent it to my husband right away. I have a 13-year-old stepson. I'm white, and he is mixed race. He's half black, half Japanese. And I'm just so profoundly scared for the world he's growing up in. So reading your article was, it was just putting into words so much of what I feel and things I didn't even knew I feel. So I just wanted to thank you for that. I also completely just want to agree with you in the sense that there's so much hope in this generation as well. You know, he is attending climate marches, and we talk about race all the time. We talk about, you know, what's going on in the world. It's just, it does strike me as a generation that's so much more aware, maybe. I don't know if that's a New York City thing, but just so much more aware of the world they're growing up in.
Dr. Alexander?
Thank you. Thank you for those comments. And I think that one of the things that is so challenging as a parent, even outside these mortal issues of race and vulnerability, is how do we teach them to be careful, aware, smart, cautious where appropriate, at the same time that we don't want them to be governed by fear. Because I think that for, you know, our children to be governed by fear takes away their might and their bodaciousness and their, you know, willingness to push boundaries and think of solutions that we haven't before. You know, we can't have our children moving tentatively through life. We can't allow the fear to domesticate our mighty children. And so I hear you speaking to that balance, and it's wonderful to hear about the awareness of and the marching and the climate understanding. And I think that what we have the benefit of in this generation as parents is all of the knowledge and critical tools of African American studies, gender studies, LGBTQ studies, all of those fields of knowledge have given us ways to think and teach within our families and our communities intersectionally, so that we know that history is multifaceted, that there are simultaneous and competing versions of history, that history is not a monolith, that communities are more powerful when they are varied and diverse and can sustain real debate and contest.
And I'm going to jump in.
It's nothing to be afraid of. Sorry. Yes.
No, that's okay. And I want to jump in only to give you the last minute of the show to put on your president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation hat and talk about these two new initiatives that the foundation just announced this morning, a new focus on social justice in your arts and humanities grant making in general, and the new program to place 500,000 books in prisons and juvenile facilities across the U.S. Would you like to introduce that to our listeners in under a minute?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. It is exhilarating to be leading the Mellon Foundation now because we've just moved things in a direction where all of our grant making will be coming through a social justice lens, which is to say explicitly contributing to a more fair and just society. And I'm especially thrilled about the Million Book Project. Dwayne Betts, the poet, is leading it at the Yale Law School Justice Collaboratory, and it will put 500 book libraries into every medium and maximum security men's facility, all women's facility, juvenile detention centers in every state, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. These are freedom books that are designed to help people imagine empowered lives.
And,
I couldn't be more exhilarated.
And that has to be the last word. Everybody, read Elizabeth Alexander's transcendent New Yorker essay, The Trayvon Generation. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful time here. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.